Welcome to Evidence Based, a new Harbinger psychology podcast. I'm your host, Cassie Stossel. On today's episode, we're talking about love addiction. Our guest is Dr. Courtney Warren, author of Letting Go of Your Ex. Courtney is a board-certified clinical psychologist and former tenured associate professor of psychology at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Having won numerous professional awards for her research, Warren is an expert on addictions, eating pathology, self-deception, and the practice of psychotherapy from a cross-cultural perspective. In addition to her academic work, Warren is a speaker, author, and coach with a passion for bringing psychological tools to the public. She earned her doctorate from Texas A&M University after completing a clinical internship at McLean Hospital, Harvard Medical School in 2006. Hi, Courtney. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Cassie. It's delightful to talk with you.
I'm really excited to talk about this topic. So I thought we could kick off by, I want to ask, what is love addiction and what does it feel like to be addicted to your ex?
Love addiction is a non-clinical term that we use in mental health circles to really describe someone who seems hyper-fixated on a current or former lover to such a degree that it's really hurting their life, their ability to function, their well-being, their happiness. And so there's a really large emerging neurobiological body of research to suggest that when we fall in love, we are actually designed in our brains and in our bodies to become addicted to our mate. And so the experience of being addicted to someone actually is a really euphoric one when you're falling in love with someone who's really healthy for you and who really wants to be with you as much as you want to be with them. It's that magical, you get butterflies in your stomach, you're thinking about them, you're fantasizing about your future together, you're planning for the next time you get to see them, that overarching, overwhelming, euphoric experience that anyone who's ever fallen in love probably can relate to. The problem really emerges when you fall in love with someone who doesn't fall in love with you, or who is really unhealthy for you in some way, or where just the quality of your relationship actually isn't working. And so if that happens and you then break up, oftentimes people experience this hugely painful, gut-wrenching reaction where they're still focused on their ex-lover. They're still focused on this person who is so compelling and important to them in their life, but they're no longer there because they're broken up. And so in that way, feeling addicted to your mate can lead to a host of mental health symptoms and problems that are incredibly painful for people.
Yeah, and you use the term exaholic in your book. Can you talk about what the symptoms of an exaholic breakup are?
Exaholic is a colloquial term that you'll hear people sometimes use to describe that feeling of love addiction to someone after you've broken up. Instead of being an alcoholic or a chocoholic or a workaholic, you are an exaholic. You are addicted to your ex. And some of the core symptoms that we see in people who are exaholic or who are just really struggling after a bad breakup are the following: cravings for contact. You want to talk to your ex. You want to see them. You want answers. You want some kind of continued discussion, dialogue, contact, because in the short term, it makes you feel better because this person who really, really, really was important to you is at least in touch with you, at least contacting you. And when that happens, you get this little rush and dopamine hit in your brain, even when the contact is a fight. Or even if it's really unpleasant in the long run, like you're searching for information about them and you find out that they're dating someone who was a friend of yours. Intellectually, that might be totally painful to admit, but in the moment, just the seeking of information feels better for a little microsecond. We also find this hyper preoccupation, intrusive thinking and rumination, where people will say, gosh, I don't want to think about them anymore. We're broken up. We're not together. But for some reason, as much as I want to stop thinking about them, I can't. It's like my mind is completely preoccupied with them. We also find really unhelpful acting out behaviors that usually are either focused at making contact with an ex or at distracting ourselves from the pain of the breakup. So when you're trying to contact your ex, that would be anything from rereading old emails to looking them up on social media to asking friends what they're doing to stopping by old restaurants or coffee shops or hangouts where you know they might be. And when we're thinking about distracting ourselves, it's oftentimes avoidance behavior. So you might find yourself drinking or smoking or eating or doing things almost as a compensatory action to just not think about your ex for the moment. Sometimes we also find behaviors like dating new people, even when you're really not ready to and you don't even necessarily want to date them. It's that feeling of, well, I just need to do something, do anything, go shopping, walk around. And sometimes if those behaviors are self-care behaviors, like going out with your friends or calling a trusted family member or going for a walk or going to the gym, some of those distracting behaviors can actually be really helpful to healing. But if they're done impulsively, meaning you're not really thinking about what you're doing, you're just acting and reacting to try to distract yourself from your pain, or if you're acting in ways that you know are going to be harmful in the long run, then we really want to tackle those as a starting point in treatment.
Well, and Courtney, where does this addiction come from? Like, it feels like, is it possible to have one relationship where you don't sort of end up feeling this way?
Yes. You know, the reality is, as humans, we are social beings. We need contact. We need love. Actually, love is really neurobiologically a drive. It's a need. It's a way of connecting to other humans. And when you think about infants, little tiny babies, from the time we're born, we actually will not survive without people, without someone to love us, take care of us, meet our basic needs. If anyone out there has ever been around kids, you know that we're not capable of taking care of ourselves. And in that way, there's a large body of psychology and mental health experts who look at what we call attachment. We look at how we bond to other people and get our needs met from a really, really young age. And so there are so many complicated interactions of factors that play into who we date and who we're attracted to and how close we can be to people from a psychological perspective that are actually really rooted in a lot of what we learned about ourselves and other people and the world from a very early age. So when you move forward to yourself as a dating adult, you're not going to fall in love with everyone you meet. You're not going to be attracted to everyone you meet. You may date some people and go through a breakup, and actually it's a relief. Or you don't think about them anymore. Or you think, oh, I'm so glad that's over because that really wasn't working for me. Whereas other people, you date them and you know very quickly, oh, I'm really attracted to this person. Or, oh, I am falling head over heels. I am madly in love. That's the kind of addictive love that I'm really talking about in this book. But also when we talk about love addiction, oftentimes there is this overly falling in love experience, which activates these really central, emotionally based survival drives in your brain that not only activate certain areas of your brain, but certain neurotransmitters and hormones in your body that truly are designed to make you want to be with this person as much as humanly possible. And evolutionarily, we think this is because we are animals at heart, and we are biologically driven to have sex, want to be with someone long enough that if we get pregnant or if we have children, we will be devoted to this person to ensure all of our survival, certainly of this infant that we're creating. And so it really, in that way, is not a rational process. And that's one reason why exaholics or people who are really struggling to get over those breakups with that person that you fell madly in love with will say to me, I want to let this go. My rational mind knows that it's over, or that this person isn't healthy for me, or that we're not going to make this work. But it's like my body and my heart and my being are compelled to them still. How can I stop that? And that's really this dichotomy between our thinking prefrontal cortex brain that can rationally make decisions based on information and this really old part of our brain and body that says we are compelled, we have urges, we are driven to survive. And sometimes those parts of us are actually in conflict. And part of the goal of healing after a breakup is really to learn to work with ourselves in those very honest, sort of non-rational tendencies and make our conscious decisions based in reason over time, so that over time we're not so compelled towards this person anymore.
That makes a lot of sense with the sort of two parts of your brain competing for this situation. And in your book, you talk about the exaholic cycle. Can you say more about what that is?
Yes. So one thing that I find is really useful for people to understand who are going through a bad breakup is that there is a cycle of symptoms that really makes a lot of sense. And if I can help you understand it, we can intervene in it, right? We can create ways for you to learn skills and practice them that actually stop your symptoms from being so overwhelming and miserable. And the cycle really starts with contact with your ex. It really starts with this hyper focus on them as if they're the center of your life. Because one thing that we know that happens when you're in a relationship, particularly when you're in love with someone, is that they become the center of your world. You picture yourself falling in love with someone and they are sort of all that you can think about and all that you want to be with, and all of your energy and your dreams and your fantasies and your euphoric experiences include this person in your life. So after a breakup, one of the things that happens is that they're still the focus of your life in many ways. Even if you're crazy mad at them, even if you think you hate them, they still have this energy and this kind of control over you in the sense that you're so focused on them. So starting from there, because you're so focused on them, there's a desire to want contact with them. And if you have contact with them in the sense that you're still talking to them, you're still sleeping with them, you're still thinking about them a lot, as we talked a little bit about earlier, it'll give you a little bit of relief. You'll feel a tiny bit better. This also includes all of those actions that don't include them directly, but are about them, like wearing their t-shirt or trying to go around the house and look at gifts that they gave you or letters they wrote or old emails, because in your own mind, then you're still making contact with them and it'll give you a tiny bit of relief. But in the long run, that contact will make all of your symptoms worse. And that cycle that we're describing, Cassie, is the fixation on your ex leading you to want to contact them, which lets you feel a little bit better in the moment. But in the long run, it leads you to think about them more, to feel emotionally gutted, to act in ways that are generally unhelpful and harmful to you. And all of it is going to cycle back to this hyperfixation on them where you want to contact them again. And it keeps you in this loop of symptoms, of cravings, of emotional distress and reactivity, of feeling unsure of your own identity in your skin, of who you are and what matters to you now, that's really, really impairing and upsetting to most people.
Well, and I wonder, so the person who's dealing with these symptoms, what if their ex continually comes back to them? Do you have any advice for stopping that contact when it's coming toward them, not from them?
Of course. And you know, that's such a common experience in breakups. In psychological terms, sometimes we call it relationship churning or grappling. It's that period where perhaps you've broken up, but neither one of you or one of you isn't really convinced that you're broken up. And so you're kind of half in, half out. People are still reaching out. You might be trying to convince yourself or your ex that you can fix it, that you can change, that you should still hang in there, that there are ways that you can make this work. And that can be an incredibly painful place to be, because usually when you're in that place, you're not getting what you really want or need from the relationship. If you find yourself in a situation where your ex is continuing to reach out to you and you know that that's going to make it harder for you to move on, because one of the first things that I encourage people to do when they come into therapy or when they're trying to get over their ex is to cut off contact as much as humanly possible. Because as we talked about that cycle, that model, it's really the contact that's going to keep you in it. It's going to keep you focused on this relationship, even though the relationship is no longer. And so learning to set healthy boundaries is one of the first steps. If your ex continues to reach out to you, it will be very helpful for you to establish expectations about how you want to interact with them, whether you want to interact with them, when you want to interact with them, in a respectful but very clear and direct way. So for example, if your ex is sending you late night text messages, "I miss you, I want to see you, can I come over?" You might set a boundary that says this: "Right now, we're broken up. And that's really hard for me, and it might be really hard for you. But in order for me to move on, I need some space. So I would respectfully ask that you not contact me anymore. If you do send me a message, particularly if it's late at night, I'm not going to respond. I wish you the best." And in that way, you're setting up an expectation with your ex of what you'd want and what you're going to do if what you want isn't respected. The next step there is you have to follow through with whatever you set as the consequence, right? So if you say to your ex, "Don't send me a late night text," you have to hold yourself accountable for not responding when they do. But that is something that you can practice. There is hope. There are so many skills that all of us can learn to use to help ourselves get out of that cycle and emerge from a breakup actually in a more empowered, self-respecting way. Because even in the most difficult of circumstances, there's always something that you can learn about yourself. And there are always ways that you can empower and grow your self-esteem, your self-knowledge, your way of being in the world that ultimately will serve you incredibly well, whether you're single or dating the next great love of your life.
That's really empowering for you to say. And I think more people need to hear that, like that you can emerge sort of a better version of yourself with more self-respect and all of that. So with any addiction, there are triggers. What are some ways that someone can understand what their triggers are and manage those?
Triggers are circumstances or situations or reminders that make you want to use. So when we talk about any addiction, whether it's drugs or alcohol or a behavior like gambling or love, when you're talking about an ex or a chocolate, we're really talking about an internal experience or a situational factor that when you see it, you want to use. And in this case, that means you want to talk to your ex. You want to make contact with them. Some of the most common triggers that people report who are going through a breakup are things like seeing information about them on social media, where you see a picture of them at a party, or you see a picture of them dating, or they look really happy, or they look really handsome or beautiful. And your immediate response is, oh, I want to go see them. I want to show up at the party. I want to know who that girl is that they're dating. I want to know whatever it is. It's this immediate kind of gut response. It could also be things that are internal. Like you get in an argument with your mom, and in the past when you were dating your ex, they were the person you wanted to talk to about it, and they were your support, and so you immediately want to contact your ex. It could be something that looks really benign, like you are watching TV and you see an ad for a TV show that you guys used to watch together, or a sporting team that was your ex's favorite, or walking by a coffee shop and hearing somebody order a double cappuccino with caramel, and that was what your ex always drank, right? So it really could be anything. The thing to remember about triggers is that it's very useful for you to understand what your biggest triggers are. Because when you have an appreciation and understanding that you're going to be in a situation that's going to be hard for you, you can plan for it. You can go into it saying, this is a situation where I'm going to want to reach out because I'm going to be surrounded by things that remind me of my ex, or that make me miss them more, or that make me crave them and think about them more. And so the more you can prepare for that by having a pre-planned awareness of what you're going to do instead of contacting your ex, the better position you're going to be in. So for example, if it's, you know, the 4th of July, or there's a holiday coming up where you always used to see your ex, you can go into it saying, I know this is going to be extra hard for me. I'm going to practice mindfulness relaxation in the morning. I'm going to set up a lunch date with my best friend. I am going to journal an extra half an hour. And if I have a really rough moment that is probably going to emerge, I'm going to excuse myself if it's a social situation. I'm going to go to the bathroom and I'm going to let myself just be in that panically distraught, horrible emotional state until 5 or 10 minutes later when I say, okay, got to let out that emotion, acknowledge this hurts, acknowledge this isn't what I want, but radically accept that this is what I'm going through right now. And so I have a choice. I'm going to let myself feel my feelings and then I'm going to go back into it and do the best I can. And so the more you understand yourself and your triggers, the better off you're going to be in the long run.
Yeah, and being able to plan for those things gives you your power back, sort of.
No question. Actually, I would say probably the most important thing we can do for ourselves as humans is know ourselves. This is really a journey of self-knowledge. And the more we understand who we are, our personality, our vulnerabilities, why we have difficulty in intimate relationships, our early childhood learnings, all of that, the more we understand it, the more empowered we become to create the life that we really want to live based on the choices that we make for ourselves.
Absolutely. And Courtney, in all this process, when do you feel is the best time for somebody to actually seek out a therapist to work through this with?
I really believe that therapy is a gift you give yourself. I tremendously encourage anyone who's interested in therapy to find a good therapist, whether you're having really extreme or clinically impairing symptoms, or whether you're just saying, you know, this is a tough breakup for me. And I've dated a lot of people and I see patterns in myself that are a little bit upsetting to me. Like I seem to be attracted to people who are already in another relationship. What does that mean? Why am I attracted to people who are emotionally unavailable? Or I tend to be attracted to people who are dangerous or don't treat me nicely. Why is that? If you find yourself in this situation, I would say, what a wonderful opportunity to have a professional who knows a lot about mental health walk you through a journey of trying to understand yourself differently. So for anyone out there who's interested in therapy, I would say bravo. It takes a tremendous amount of bravery and courage to be vulnerable to another human being. And if you're open to it, it can be a wonderful gift. All of that said, if you are really struggling, such that you're having trouble getting out of bed, you have crying spells every day where you feel out of control and so emotional that you can't engage in general activities that you want to do in your life, like go to work or go to school or see your friends or get out of the house. Certainly, if you're feeling suicidal or homicidal or incredibly aggressive, you're stalking your ex, you can't seem to let go, and it's really affecting the quality of your life, those are the situations where I would say it's probably really in your best interest right now to find a mental health professional in your area. And if you're having any extreme symptoms, like you are starting to think you might be really depressed or you're having panic attacks, definitely seeking help would be my strongest recommendation.
Did you grow up with an emotionally immature, unavailable, or selfish parent? Join Lindsay C. Gibson, author of the self-help hit Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, for a 6-week intensive online course. You'll learn essential skills to reclaim your true self, build emotional resilience, and nurture healthy relationships. Sign up to learn more at newharbinger.com/gibson-gift and receive a free excerpt bundle from Gibson's books. New Harbinger Online Courses, expert help for better mental health.
I want to talk about red flag exaholic thinking. What is that, and what are some ways to challenge that?
Red flag thinking is another way of talking about thinking that is highly untrue and unhelpful. So in cognitive behavioral therapy, we talk a lot about cognitive distortions, which are really ways of thinking that are fundamentally flawed, but we don't think they're flawed in the moment. We think they're accurate. There is a very natural human tendency to want to believe that the thoughts that run through our minds are truth, with a capital T, that they're accurate, that what we think is a reasonable reflection of reality. But the truth is, so many of our thoughts are highly unhelpful and highly flawed. They're actually really inaccurate. And so that's what you will hear cognitive behavioral therapists call cognitive distortions, or what I call red flag thinking in this book. And there are a host of them. One of the most common is denial, which probably everyone out there has heard of. This is thinking that absolutely refuses to acknowledge something about reality. So you may deny the situation that you're in with your ex. It's also very common in the grieving process. When you're realizing that you're losing someone that really mattered to you, for you want to deny, our relationship is not over. My ex absolutely loves me. They are absolutely going to change. We're going to get back together. All of those are a version of denying reality, where the truth is that at the moment, at least, your relationship is not working for one or both of you, and it isn't currently reflected in the dynamic that you have. So if you're reading this book, there's a very good chance that you are broken up. And so the more you deny reality, the more your thinking is going to be skewed towards believing something that's fundamentally flawed. And it's also not going to be helpful for you, because the more you are mired in self-deception, in thinking things that aren't true, the more you're going to make choices based in those untruths, and the more stuck you're going to stay in this relationship dynamic. So another really common one is rationalization. This is any time you want to give a reason to excuse your own or your ex's behavior. So things like, well, they wouldn't have treated me that way if they weren't so unhappy at work. Or, well, they wouldn't have cheated on me if that person wasn't so available and throwing themselves all over them. Or, I wouldn't be so upset if they just told me they loved me more often. These are, again, deceptive because they're ways that your thinking is trying to protect you from a fundamental truth that's really, really painful and hard to admit. But the truth is, usually, that rationalization doesn't help you in the long run. The truth is that your ex acted the way they acted because that was their choice and way of being in the world. The truth is that you're having an emotional reaction to something, probably partly because of how your ex acted or the reality of your life, but also partly because of how you're choosing to respond to it and the way that you're thinking about it and framing the situation that you're in your own mind. And the more that you can become aware of those thinking patterns that you have, the more we can help you change your thinking and challenge your thinking to be more accurate and helpful for you so that your thinking actually is reflective of the truth of the situation that you're working in more an objective way. And less focused on what you wish were true, which is really what self-deceptive thinking leads us to believe.
Yeah, and along with that, you also write about faulty beliefs. Can you talk about what are some common faulty beliefs that we might carry about our exes?
Faulty beliefs or core beliefs or schemas, you'll hear these terms by psychologists and mental health professionals, are sort of underneath the beliefs that we think that fuel those red flag thoughts. They're these more fundamental truths that you have concluded about yourself and about other people and the world around you. And we start forming these beliefs really young in our lives. And then as we grow, fortunately and unfortunately, we collect evidence to support our beliefs most of the time. Some of the most common core beliefs and schemas that I see people have about their ex after a breakup are these. One, that your ex was perfect, or at least that they were perfect for you. Two, that they were the best, and you're never going to find anyone else that was as wonderful as they were. Three, that you're never going to get over them, because at some fundamental level, they completed you, which is also a culturally enforced and reinforced belief system in Western contexts that's very harmful for people. Four, that if you loved each other enough, your relationship would work or you could make it work. And five, that you can change them or that they will change. And when I see people really mired in those beliefs, the unfortunate thing is that they will keep you hyperfixated on your ex because they're all fundamentally based on this sort of core overarching belief that you need them to be okay, that you need them to be fulfilled, that you need them to be whole and healed, that somehow they define you as a human being. And the fundamental reality that I want everyone to learn and know and absolutely foundationally walk around the world believing is that you define your value. Your ex, whether they want you or love you or hate you or mistreated you or reject you or left you for another person, actually has no, absolutely no fundamental effect on your value as a person. And so in this process of transformation and empowerment, as you go through a breakup, the hope is you learn to manage and understand your symptoms in the moment that are really making you miserable and stuck on them. You start to understand the patterns of thinking and beliefs that you have developed over the course of your life, both about your ex and your relationship with your ex, and about you as a person that started a long, long time ago in your family of origin. Unpack those and challenge them so that as you move forward, into your future and into your great life adventure that is yet to come. You get a perspective on who you are, what you care about, what your values are, and what your fundamental value is as a person that you will carry with you into your future relationships so that moving forward, you get healthier and healthier and more fulfilled and happier.
Yeah. And you've mentioned a few times about your core beliefs about yourself, you know, coming really early in life from your family of origin. Do you see some common core beliefs that people carry about themselves that sort of fuel this love addicted feeling?
Absolutely. It would be ideal if all of us were raised in a really healthy family system and a healthy cultural system and social system that taught us that we are valuable, that we are safe, that we can trust other people, that we can manage and navigate conflict in our relationships because we have this safe, secure relationship with our family. We know that we can manage as we go through life and handle whatever comes our way, that we could have a tsunami of pain, that we could have all of these difficult encounters, and we're still safe and sound in our own skin. And we have a bonded support system to help us through it. And if that happens in childhood, we generally refer to that as being securely attached with our adult caregivers. And that secure attachment actually has tremendous implications for us as we age in our relationships, very obviously in our romantic relationships. Because as you might imagine, if you go into the world thinking that you're safe, that you're loved, that it's okay to be vulnerable with other people because you will figure things out over time, you take that into your romantic relationships. And even though you may fall madly in love, which as we said is a pretty irrational experience and designed to be irrational and designed to be completely emotionally addictive, that you will go into it not being afraid of being profoundly hurt, not being afraid of being yourself and being authentic and having honest, open communication with your romantic partner. And if that's possible, and if you're attracted to people who are also able to do that with you, it lends itself to a much more fulfilling, healthy dynamic in your adult relationships. However, if you were raised in a family system or a cultural environment where you were abused in some way, you didn't feel safe, you weren't able to express your own feelings or thoughts in a healthy way where people would listen to you and validate your experiences and try to understand your experiences, or you were raised in a cultural context where you had a family member who was incarcerated or had a severe mental illness, or there was violence in your community or food scarcity in your community, where it was an impoverished area where you didn't really feel safe. What ends up happening is that you will start to doubt your ability to connect with other people, the amount that you can feel safe in interpersonal relationships. You may make conclusions about other people like, they will always leave me, or it's not safe to be in romantic relationships because love is dangerous. If you, for example, watched your parents fight or there was domestic violence, you may have concluded that you should never have an intimate relationship because that looked horrible, and you watched it happen with people you really loved. So one thing that I see often in people who go through love-addicted breakups is that a lot of these core beliefs that are based in insecure attachment of some kind bubble up in their romantic relationships. And then as they go through a breakup, they emerge very strongly in full force. And they fuel some of those unhealthy beliefs that we just talked about the ex. So if you grew up thinking something's wrong with me and love is not safe, and then you fell in love and then you broke up, you might have this profound emotional reaction to your ex that's partly because of who your ex is and how you felt about them, but partly because of the conclusions that you made about yourself and other people that are being fundamentally triggered by this romantic relationship. And so it's this combined messy combination of the two that can make you much more likely, I think, to have these love addicted breakups and make it harder to move on, because you have to try to separate out what about this is actually about this relationship with my ex, and what about this is fueling this belief that something's wrong with me and I've now attached my ex to this figure that I think I need to be safe, or that I think I need to be valued. Because this rejection, all it leads me to believe is this re-experiencing of something's wrong with me. And in therapy, that's something we absolutely need to tackle and try to help unpack and understand and heal, so that you don't end up in romantic relationships with your ex in the future or with a new person in the future where they are triggering these profound core beliefs based in vulnerability and shame and pain that are never going to be healed in the romantic relationship with your ex. They have to be healed with yourself, so that at some level you challenge that core belief that you learned long ago that says I'm unlovable or I'm unsafe, to shift it into a, I am absolutely lovable. I absolutely can have trusting relationships. And part of that means I have to work on my own intimacy issues. And part of that means I need to be more careful with who I date and the positions I may put myself in that lead me to fall in love with or want to be with people who trigger probably an unhealthy aspect of myself and are going to predispose me to feel worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you don't work on that, it just carries into other relationships in the future. So it's really, really important to work through that.
It's so important. You know, we all have patterns and we all have pain and we all have vulnerabilities. That is just true. You know, life is really hard as a human, and especially if you're deliberate in trying to understand yourself, it takes tremendous work to really dive deep into who you are and what you learned, because it hurts. Self-deception serves a very important function. It protects us for information that's incredibly painful to admit. But if we don't acknowledge it, we're actually limiting our freedom. We're limiting our ability to make choices based on who we are and what we need in this life to have a fulfilling future. And so it's this constant battle, or what I would call a dialectic. You'll hear therapists use that term, where on the one hand, we're always trying to change and grow and evolve because that's the journey of life. And on the other hand, to do that, you have to look at things in your life that are painful. And that is such a difficult thing to process. And the more self-esteem we have, the more I can encourage people to find their value, to find a deep inner knowing that you deserve to be in this life, that you have self-efficacy, that you have some control over what happens to you and how your life evolves and transforms and emerges, the better able you'll be to see reality objectively, to see the truth, to look at this breakup and your ex in raw form with all the good and all the bad and radically accept it. Say things like, my ex was a person just like the rest of us. And as much as I was in love with them, there were things about them that were really wonderful, and there were things about them that were really difficult for me. And the truth is that right now we're broken up. And as much as I may not want that to be true, it is. So what can I do with this information? How can I respond to it? How can I use it to help me and not hurt me? And the more you do that each day, you have this wonderfully compounding effect where all of the seemingly small things you do, like challenging your thinking, or instead of checking for them on social media, say, pause, I'm not going to do that today. Instead, I'm not going to look at my social media and I'm going to go for a walk. Every one of those seemingly small choices compounds and builds and builds on itself. So at some point, you will look back on this entire relationship journey with your ex with really no emotional reaction at all. You will look at it, hopefully at some point, even with a smile, and say, wow, that was tough. That was brutal. I don't ever want to do that again. But I also appreciate that I learned a great deal about myself, and my ex actually has no power over me anymore, because I can stare it down in the face and say, thank you for the experience. I learned a great deal about myself in the process, and I have chosen to use what I've learned and bring it into my being, integrate it into who I am and what I understand about myself, so that I can enjoy my present again.
Courtney, that was so powerful and so healthy. And I feel like that's a good place for us to wrap up, unless you have any final thoughts for the listeners.
My only final thoughts are this. Know that there is hope. Research suggests that almost all of us as humans are actually going to go through a brutal breakup where we would describe it as our heart is broken, but we're also very likely to break someone else's heart. And so know that this is really part of a human journey, and there are ways that you can learn skills to help yourself get through it. You're not alone in this struggle. It's a very human experience. And as much as it may be painful right now or in the moment, over time with practice, there are so many ways that you can help yourself through it.
Thank you so much, Courtney, for your time and your expertise. I know a lot of readers will learn a lot about themselves from your book. I know I did. And thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed chatting with you, Cassie.
Are you struggling to get over a former lover? Do thoughts and memories of your ex occupy your mind day and night? Do you wish you could talk to them, touch them, see them, anything to make you feel close again? Are you consumed by anger, sadness, frustration, or unbearable pain that your relationship is over? If so, you're not alone, and you may be going through a love-addicted breakup. For people who struggle with love addiction, breakups can be downright devastating, yet there are tools that you can use to start healing. Letting Go of Your Ex offers powerful, evidence-based skills grounded in cognitive behavioral therapy to help you manage intense emotions, get unstuck from the past, and start focusing on what makes you happy now. Feeling addicted to your ex can leave you in a constant state of craving and withdrawal, but you can emerge as a stronger, more honest, and authentic version of yourself. This compassionate and practical guide can help you heal your pain and start enjoying your life again with or without your ex. You'll learn how and why love can function like an addiction, how to change the harmful beliefs that keep you stuck on your ex, how childhood experiences affect adult romantic relationships, and how to avoid recreating old dynamics in a new relationship. Visit our website at www.newharbinger.com and use coupon code PODCAST25 to receive 25% off your entire order. New Harbinger Publications is an independent, employee-owned publisher of books on psychology, health, spirituality, and personal growth. For 50 years, our evidence-based self-help books and pioneering workbooks have helped readers make positive changes to improve mental health and well-being. Founded by psychologists Matthew McKay and Patrick Fanning, New Harbinger is proud to be an employee-owned company. Our books reflect our core values of integrity, sustainability, compassion, and trust. Written by leaders in the field and recommended by therapists worldwide, New Harbinger books are practical, accessible, and provide real tools for real change.
Earning your continuing education hours doesn't have to be a painful experience. The right course can open your mind to new possibilities, increase your confidence, and hand you powerful tools to transform your clients' lives. Praxis Continuing Education and Training teams up with some of the brightest minds in mental health to provide cutting-edge, evidence-based training for practitioners. You can learn firsthand from experts like Stephen C. Hayes, Kelly Wilson, Robin Walzer, Kirk Strozzle, and many others. Find your next training at praxisCET.com. That's praxisCET.com.
If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love if you rated, reviewed, and subscribed to the show, and we hope you might share it with anyone who might benefit from the content. This podcast is not a substitute for counseling with a licensed provider.